dopamine-rattling cry. Her face turns crimson fast. It's the flip side of that peaches and cream complexion.
She might need to eat, Doug says.
He looks at his watch casually.
How long's it been?
Can you get the bottle out of her diaper bag, please? Sadie is screaming, eyes bulging. It's like we've never fed her before. It's that way every time. I shift her in my arms and coo, even as I know it won't work. Only the bottle will do. Still, I want them to see that I'm a loving mother. The first hangout is always an audition. Doug hands the bottle to me, and Sadie wraps her lips around it, eyelids drooping dramatically.
You're not breastfeeding either?
Andy asks me. She's drinking my milk, but she never latched.
So you pump all her milk?
As I nod, Andy smiles at me.
Good for you. That takes a lot of discipline. I'd miss my wine too much.
Not that she has the option, Nolan says. Fisher's adopted.
He looks at Fisher fondly, like an especially good acquisition. I don't know why I thought that. There's nothing overtly objectionable about Nolan. He just reminds me of someone. I can't place who, but it's unsettling.
Why don't we relocate?
Andy smacks her head.
Sorry about that. I've got you feeding your daughter in the foyer. Follow me.
We trail her to the dining room. It's through a doorway that's limed with mahogany, framed like a picture. There's a casement window and persimmon-colored draperies left open to reveal brighter light than the other parts of the house we've glimpsed. There's a long, narrow antique table with 8 chairs upholstered the pale green color of seagrass.
Jesus, that's beautiful, I blurt.
Andy grins.
This is actually my favorite room.
Andy did the decorating herself, Nolan says, with some consultation.
She had an interior designer, is what he probably means. But who cares? It's still Andy's vision that I love. The table is laid out with a lavish spread, all sorts of crackers, cheeses, olives, and dips, of which I can only recognize hummus. Nolan starts to point and name things like walnut pomegranate, but I'm transfixed by the kitchen beyond. It's immense, with vintage red painted cabinets, a random plank wood floor, and an enormous kitchen island. And it has the most amazing ceiling I've ever seen. A series of sunken square panels, each made out of a different species of wood with its own unique patinas.
What do you call that?
I ask, pointing upward. I suddenly feel the weight of Sadie in my arms. I'm startled to realize I've forgotten her. I don't even usually care about architecture.
It's a coffered ceiling made of reclaimed wood, Andy says. The dining room is my favorite room, but that ceiling is my favorite thing in the whole house.
She smiles at me, and I smile back, like we're kindred spirits. I haven't felt that way about a friend since Ellen, and I was 6 years old when Ellen and I met. Sometimes I think I would have deeply loved anyone I met at that period of my life, before anything bad had happened to me. When I was so open to the world that I would have imprinted on any child just like ducklings do. Andy pours the Perrier for me, and she, Doug, and Nolan share the bottle of Napa Pinot. We all settle down at the table. Andy puts a high chair for Fisher at one end and a guest high chair for Sadie at the other. Never one to hold back, Doug makes it clear that he has just been served the greatest wine that man or nature has ever created. I try not to feel resentful as I sip my water. Sadie is banging her fists on the tray of the high chair with glee, while Fisher sits solemnly in his.
What was the adoption process like?
Somehow, from Doug, the question doesn't seem invasive.
Stressful. And then exhilarating, Andy says.
We flew around the country and got grilled and waited to be chosen.
Nolan sounds affable enough on the surface, but I sense an undertone. He isn't used to waiting for anything. He's typically the one asking the questions.
We got close 3 different times.
Andy says. We were the runners-up. It makes you wonder, what did we do wrong? Why not us? And then you try to change that the next time, and sometimes you overcorrect. You overcompensate. She looks at Nolan. Am I saying too much?
Nolan says to Doug and me. She tends to talk a lot when she meets new people. Doug nods with complete understanding. Cat clams up.
My face ignites. Now I have to speak up and prove him wrong. You were telling us about the adoption?
Oh, right, Andy says, like she's grateful that I kept her on track. So, it was getting discouraging and tiring, all that flying around the country, trying to impress, and then we met Fisher's parents and we just didn't have it in us to put on a show.
And that won them over, I say.
Now I'm overcorrecting, talking too much. Doug is, as usual, being the consummate listener, leaning in just enough, making Andy feel like she's the most fascinating woman he's ever encountered.
No, Andy answers. The other couple fell through, and we got a call from the adoption worker months later, while Fisher's mother was in labor.
I pick up the phone, Nolan interjects, and there's Danielle from New Connections. You're about to be a father. Andy and I had 3 hours to kiss our old lives goodbye before we got on the plane.
Wow, Doug says.
If it were me, those 3 hours would include a lot of sex and alcohol and dancing naked and eating Cheetos.
Laughs all around.
Were you spying on us?
Andy asks. Everyone laughs again.
It occurs to me that we're all just waiting to be chosen for something, all wanting to find out that we're good enough. It's comforting to know that even with all their resources, the King's Spuds aren't immune. And then Andy says,
9 months of that roller coaster. I guess we can't complain. It's the normal gestation period, isn't it?
It's not the normal gestation period for a domestic adoption, I know that. I've heard people wait years for a white newborn. I think of all those people languishing on the adoption rolls while Nolan and Andy just slid through. But then, it probably wasn't just a rough 9 months for them. It was most likely years of trying and maybe infertility treatments. You never know other people's struggles. They can't tell mine looking at me. At least, I hope they can't.
Are you a stay-at-home mom, Katrina? Andy asks.
Please call me Kat. And not exactly. I'm still on maternity leave. I look at Sadie, feeling the anticipatory pang of leaving her. I'm grateful that she's so content with her banging, that she's not on the verge of one of her inconsolable outbursts, though it occurs to me that I haven't had anything to eat yet myself. I've been too nervous about how I'm coming off. I overcorrect again, filling the gold-rimmed plate with far too much of everything.
What work do you do?
Nolan says.
I'm an assistant provost.
What exactly is a provost?
He's smiling at me, and my stomach curdles, though he's being perfectly nice. There's nothing inappropriate in the question or in his manner. I detail my duties overseeing the admissions process, trying to capture how stimulating it actually can be. There's something about that stage of young people's lives, when they're so full of promise and the thirst of competition. I love it. Well, I used to love it. I don't know how that version of myself will jibe with whoever it is I've become. Nolan is nodding politely. I'm not getting it across. I was a communicator in my other life, pre-Sadie. In work, I was always so sure of myself. Lately, I falter. But that's why I need to get out more. Nights like this are important before I go back to the office.
That does sound fascinating, Andy says. I'm just home with Fisher, and I volunteer. I'm a member of different boards. It sounds so frivolous, doesn't it? But I'm fulfilled, mostly. That's the weirdest part.
What did you used to do?
Nolan and Andy exchange a glance so quickly that I think maybe I imagined it.
I was an art history major.
Then she met me,
Nolan says. There's more of a story there, but neither of them seems eager to tell it, which is notable since they'd offered up Fisher's adoption tale so readily. But who doesn't have more of a story than they want to tell?
Where did you two meet?
Andy asks.
Online, I answer.
On Tinder? Andy says, teasing. We're old school, pre-app, Doug smiles at me. But I would have swiped right for her. I smile back. On Match.com, I had checked the box for casual dating, wanting companionship, not at all equipped for intimacy. And Doug had checked the box for serious relationship. But he changed my mind. I'd never thought I'd be the marrying kind, let alone the mothering kind, and yet here I am, courtesy of him. He made me want both. No, more than that, he made me believe I could be good at both. Not that I want to go into any of that. The walnut pomegranate spread is phenomenal. Nolan slides the serving platter down. Please, have more.
Gina and Oliver met online, too. Andy sips her wine. I think he used to be a real player.
Which people are those? Doug asks. I'm not sure I met them.
He's tall and thin, graying mustache.
He looks exactly like John Waters, Nolan interrupts. It's uncanny.
And their house is impeccable.
If Andy is calling someone's house impeccable, I don't even want to imagine.
Gina's the one whose hair is shaped like a mushroom, I say.
Andy lets out a peal of delighted laughter.
It totally is. She's going to girls' night, right? I query. She's a regular.
Are you a regular? Doug says to Andy. I need to know more about this cult that's recruiting my wife. Andy's not a regular, Nolan answers. It's a very, how do I put it, selective group.
And they haven't selected Andy? I want to know what that says about them, or about her, but there's no tactful way to ask.
I didn't know we were surrounded by snobs, Doug says. But you can't tell everything from one block party.
No, it's not like that. Andy is directing her comments at me. They're all great. Every last one of them. Tennyson, June, Yolanda, Gina, Raquel. You couldn't ask for better neighbors. We're going to have so much fun on Thursday.
If they're all great, and Andy's clearly great, then why isn't she a regular? Which one's Raquel? Doug says. Is her hair shaped like a bell pepper? Then we're all laughing and talking like old friends.
It's nearly perfect. Except halfway through the main course, when I finally realize who Nolan reminds me of, and I lose my appetite completely. Chapter 7. You have 15 new posts from your good neighbors. What's the best weed whacker? Lost corgi named Bamboo. Free outdoor pizza oven. Never mind, I found Bamboo. Thanks for the outpouring. Any recommendations for home daycares? That last one is me. It's 1:49 a.m. I haven't been able to fall asleep. I just keep replaying the dinner in my mind. I like Andy so much. It's painful to think that I won't be able to be her friend just because I can't stomach her husband. Maybe I can just avoid him. There are girlfriends, and then there are couple friends. Andy and I can be the former. Unfortunately, though, Doug likes both Nolan and Andy. I don't really see how I can just cut him out of the equation, not without revealing parts of my past that I intend to keep hidden. And honestly, it's not Nolan's fault. I don't want to hold a vague resemblance against him. It feels bigoted somehow. But I can't have a relationship that's like one long PTSD flashback. Hey there. No recommendations, but I can tell you a few horror stories. Places to avoid. The kind where they let the kids fall asleep in car seats and rockin' plays. Total death traps. That response is from Yolanda. I hadn't even realized she was on Good Neighbors. I never got a welcome message from her.
I asked Andy about childcare, and of course she has a nanny. She offered information on the agency she used, and I took it, even though there's no way we can afford that kind of luxury. We can't even afford a childcare center. It's home daycares all the way for us. Andy's out of my league. She and Nolan are out of our league, both Doug's and mine. That, I decide, is why we can't take the friendship any further. Can you picture them eating in Crayola? I'll say to Doug. It's ludicrous. We can just stick with our own kind. Who would that leave in this neighborhood? I hope it's okay that we're just stopping by. Raquel has Meadow in her arms again, just like at the block party. And Meadow has her thumb in her mouth as she regards me with surprisingly dull eyes for a toddler. I didn't have your number to text you. It's fine, I say. It's good to see you. Do you want to come in? I'm still in my pajamas and bare feet, and I realize no bra. I cross my arms over my chest. Sadie is lying on the floor on her playmat, various plastic animals dangling above her along a stuffed nylon arch. She tries to grasp them, but they're out of her reach, which fortunately seems to make her more determined than frustrated.
What's she doing?
Meadow lisps around her thumb. Reaching, I say, wondering if there's a better way to explain it. Meadow seems satisfied. Once they're inside, Raquel doesn't put Meadow down. They remain intertwined as Raquel perches on a love seat.
It's cute in here, Raquel says.
It's a work in progress, but I feel like it's going to be really nice. Homey. She smiles at me.
It already is. Homey.
I smile back. Thanks.
We were about to go to the park. Do you and Sadie want to join us?
I hesitate. Raquel's so nice, but I'm just not really in the mood for getting to know you small talk. It feels like work. No, it's an investment. If I want a new kind of life, I have to be willing to put in the effort. With her brown lawn, Raquel might make a lot more sense as a friend than Andy does. Let me get dressed. I'll just be a minute. I snatch Sadie up off her mat, and she bursts into tears. Meadow's eyes widen in fascination. We go upstairs, and I grab a pacifier for Sadie. Sorry, I tell her. Last-minute change of plans. Her eyes regard me warily as I get her into a fresh diaper and clothes, but at least she's sucking instead of crying. I put on her sunscreen with long, deep strokes, turning it into a baby massage, and her eyes close in pleasure. I don't really like being in Sadie's room. For one thing, it reminds me that we're more separate than we used to be. For another, even though I chose the color purple, my mother-in-law insisted on choosing everything else, and I couldn't stop her. I can't stop her from doing anything, really. So there are preppy plaids and ginghams, matching curtains and valance and shams and trash can. Doug tells me it's a small price to pay, but sometimes when I'm in here, it still chafes. I don't normally leave Sadie tethered to the changing table, but it's just this once while I dash into my room and put on clothes. Still, I forego washing my face. I decide toothbrushing is a necessity with a new potential friend, and then I stick a sun hat on in lieu of sunscreen. It has the added benefit of covering my messy hair. I bring Sadie back downstairs. Raquel says,
Meadow never got into pacifiers. It's been all thumb her whole life.
It must be a hard habit to break.
I don't know. I haven't tried. She's always been young for her age, if you know what I mean. She's going to start half-day preschool in the fall.
How old is she?
3. Her birthday's in February.
So that means she's almost 3 and a half. I'm startled, though I hope it doesn't show. It's not just that Meadow's behavior appears to be that of a younger child. It's also that Meadow is so physically underdeveloped. She's not skinny, with spindly arms. Rather, it's the opposite. Her cheeks are too full, and her belly protrudes in that way of toddlers who've not yet been reduced by movement. She's built like a child at least a full year younger. It's concerning, almost like Meadow has failed to thrive. Yet Raquel seems so matter-of-fact. But maybe she's already spoken to her pediatrician, and Meadow's on medication, or in therapy, or whatever they do for kids who are developmentally delayed. Maybe it's just about patiently waiting for Meadow to catch up. I'm glad that Raquel doesn't seem embarrassed by Meadow, that she's not transmitting any sort of shame to her child. Raquel's matter-of-factness could be a sign that she's highly evolved. She's obviously a very loving mom. Meadow barely leaves her arms. Besides appearing younger than her age, Meadow is the most physically ordinary child I've ever seen. She has fine brown hair up in a ponytail, brown eyes, medium-toned skin, and undistinguished features. If she stays this way, she'll be well-suited to a life of crime. No witness would ever be able to describe her to a sketch artist. Kind of like Raquel, come to think of it, who's also wearing a ponytail and those wire-rimmed frames of hers, like granny glasses. Raquel puts Meadow on the ground, and Meadow whimpers. Raquel leans in and whispers for a little while, until Meadow brightens. Then they clasp hands, and we all head for the door. I have Sadie's diaper bag slung around me, messenger style, and I carry her folded-up stroller down the front steps. It used to seem like the biggest production in the world, a deterrent to casual activities, an easy excuse to stay inside where it's cozy and safe. But I'm turning a corner in the AV. Well, trying to. On the pavement, I get her into the stroller and we're off. I'm full of an inexplicable joy at this most simple of excursions, perhaps because it's so simple. It's just a trip to the park a few blocks away with a new friend and her little one, the first of many. The residential streets are built around an emerald quad. There's a baseball diamond, a soccer field, and tennis courts. The playground is a marvel, with different fenced areas for kids of varying ages and equipment ranging from the classic S triumvirate, swings, seesaws, slides, to the high-tech, geometric shapes anchored by complicated ropes and pulleys, a cross between a playground and an art installation. Much of it is under brightly colored canopies to protect the kids from the sun, lending a circus feel to the proceedings, while the parents can sit beneath long stone gazebos with mosaic tile benches. We head for the sandbox. Raquel removes her shoes and I do the same, wiggling my toes in sand that hasn't yet been warmed by the sun. I dressed Sadie in layers, in true Bay Area fashion. I'm in just a t-shirt and shorts, and I shiver a little.
"Where did you move from?" Raquel asks.
"We were living in Oakland."
"That's where I grew up, right off International Boulevard."
I wouldn't have imagined that she'd spent her childhood in one of the more dangerous neighborhoods in Oakland, a city that also has some insanely expensive ones, stratified and gentrified. If I'd grown up off International Boulevard, I might not volunteer it so readily, worrying that it would cause people to revise their opinion of me in some way I couldn't predict or control. I envy her fearlessness, that she can just present the facts of her life so, well, matter-of-factly.
"Yeah, East Oakland's as good as you've heard," she deadpans. "But awesome Mexican food. And the pawn shops?"
She mimes an expression of heavenly delight. We both laugh.
"Bart grew up there, too. We looked after each other."
Meadow is staring at Raquel like she's in a trance, while Sadie is ignoring me completely, dredging her arms through the sand in fascination.
"And no," Raquel says, "Bart isn't short for anything. He was actually named after the BART train, as in Bay Area Rapid Transit, which tells you a little something about his parents."
I don't know what it says when you name your kid after transportation, so she explains.
"His mom was a drug addict. She was still on heroin when he was born, so she couldn't think all that clearly. It was at Children's Hospital in Oakland, and she looked outside her window, and the BART tracks were right there to help her out."
Not sure how to respond, I parrot. "Heroin?
She was a trailblazer.
I mean, now heroin's an epidemic, but back then, in that neighborhood, crack was king.
Raquel is not what I expected. Not at all. When I first met her, I thought she was sweet and childlike. And in her delivery, she is, but there's steel behind it. She's seen a lot, and apparently, so has Bart. But he looks like a guy who's been around, whereas she has a quality that makes you want to protect her. Maybe that's how Bart feels about her, or used to feel about her. It sure didn't look that way at the party.
What does Bart do? I say.
He has a construction business.
Construction, of course. He could bury all the bodies in the cement foundations. Does he have unusually neat handwriting? I'm being ridiculous. I haven't received a note in a couple of days. I need to focus on what's ahead of me, not what's behind.
Did you grow up in Oakland?
Raquel asks.
No.
I prefer not to say more.
Where then?
Haynes? She furrows her brow like she's heard the name somewhere.
That sounds familiar.
It's not far, just along 880 near Newark and Union City. The furrow becomes a full ridge.
Haynes is famous for something, right?
Not really. I hope she doesn't Google it later. It's a pretty ordinary, middle-class kind of a place. I don't need to mention that there's a poor part of town, which is where my mother and I lived. By now, though, who knows? The way gentrification's going in the Bay Area, those could be million-dollar houses.
It's crazy, she shakes her head.
I'm sad. So many people being driven out. Really sad.
Meadow, why don't you go climb over there?
Raquel gestures toward a metal parabola that's not more than 3 feet off the ground at its apex. We're in the infant toddler section.
She loves that.
It's hard to imagine Meadow loving anything other than Raquel. There's just something so careful about her. Raquel and Bart must have grown up having to watch their backs, and even though they moved to a place where you should never have to look over your shoulder, their only child retains some of that awareness. I'm hoping that won't be true of Sadie. It doesn't look like it so far. She's already more of an explorer than Meadow, examining each grain of sand as it trickles through her fingers. Growing up, I had no real sense of home, unless you count Ellen's. But I want that for Sadie so much. And I suddenly realize I want it for me, too. For the little kid I used to be. The one I could have been. Meadow is shaking her head convulsively.
Meadow,
Raquel says, go. The emphatic shaking continues.
I'll walk her over and then she'll be fine.
She takes Meadow's hand and Meadow obediently accompanies her toward the small climbing structure. Sadie's been sitting between my legs and I reach to pull her into my lap, wanting a dose of nearness. But she lets out a wail. She values her independence, even if it's only a few inches, and looking at Meadow, I see that I need to encourage that in any form. Raquel returns a minute later, and I see that Meadow is now sitting on the top of the structure, watching Raquel retreat. Raquel says over her shoulder,
"Climb, Meadow!"
And Meadow does, but joylessly. Within a few minutes, she's running back.
Okay, Mama,
she asks.
You're okay,
Raquel says, though I'm not sure that's what Meadow meant. She might have meant, is Mama okay? Raquel tells Meadow to go back, to keep climbing, and Meadow does, calling back,
look at me, Mama!
For the next 10 minutes, they reenact that needy little drama over and over as if choreographed. And it all just feels so exhausting and heartbreaking that I don't think I can take it much longer. As much as I like Raquel, I'm grateful when Sadie lets out a poop so messy and noxious that I can beg off and head home.
See you tomorrow night,
Raquel says merrily.
Good girl,
I whisper to Sadie as we hurry off.
Good girl.
Unlike myself, I admire how forthcoming Raquel is about her past. She's just the kind of person I should trust, maybe even aspire to be like. But somehow, all I want to do is run.
Session 16.
You were going to tell me more about your family.
No, you asked about my family. That doesn't mean I was going to tell you.
We can just sit here quietly.
So you can make an easy $100?
So we can go at your pace. So you have control in here, since I know you don't feel like you have it in other areas of your life.
Have you heard of Haynes? Or Mr. Layton?
I don't think so. Should I have?
You must not be from around here. Good.
Let's not talk about the past right now. Let's talk about the present. How you did with resisting some of the behaviors we talked about.
It wasn't a good week. Let's just leave it at that.
You don't have to hold back. Nothing you say will shock me or make me reevaluate your worth. I won't abandon you.
What makes you think I'm afraid of those things?
They're normal fears.
You and your normalcy again.
You and your sarcasm again.
I guess we do know each other. But no one else can know me. That's why I drink. I take whatever drugs people hand me, and I have sex with people I shouldn't. People who don't give a shit about me, and I don't give a shit about them. I did it all again this week, even after all we talked about.
That's okay. We're still early in this process. We'll just keep working at it.
I just do the same thing over and over. I have, what do you call that? Impulse control problems. Or maybe it's that definition of crazy. The same thing, but expecting different results. Expecting to do dirty things, but end up feeling clean. Do you think that I'm actually crazy?
I don't use that word.
For anyone? Or just for me?
You're finding ways to cope with your pain. That's all.
All I want is oblivion. To not be me for a while.
Good. That's a good insight.
Knowing doesn't change anything. I still do the same thing again and again. You'd think I was programmed.
Childhood is a template for all that comes later.
Let's hope you're wrong about that.
Chapter 8.
Go get him,
Doug whispers to me. He's lying in our bed with Sadie in his arms, and she's sucking on a bottle, her eyes closed in absolute peace. The last thing I want is to leave them, but I was supposed to be knocking at Andy's door 5 minutes ago. No, I moan. Don't make me.
You're going to have a great time. More important, you're going to be great. They're going to get to know you, and they're going to love you.
Is he right? Is it more important to be great than to have a great time? For Doug, the two are interconnected. He enjoys himself because he's sure people are going to love him. And then they do, in a positive feedback loop. I don't have that same confidence, nor do I have the burning need. Doug thinks it's just nerves that make me want to stay here beside him and Sadie. It's not. Or at least, not only. It's that I can be fulfilled here, loving and loved by Doug and Sadie. That's my positive feedback loop. Andy's expecting me, I say. That's what it comes down to. Fulfilling my obligation. So I plant a kiss on Doug's cheek and a more lingering one on Sadie's brow, and with effort, I pull myself away. Girls' night out is not an appealing concept for me. A cluster of women could feel uncomfortably close to a mom's group, with the resultant groupthink. As I recall the rule, don't talk about motherhood, I'm hit with a new fear. What will I talk about? The work I'm afraid to return to? The debt we put ourselves in to get here? The fear that I'll never pass, I'll never belong? When Andy opens the door, it's confirmed that this is no mom's group. She's in a black leather peplum top and matching black leather pants with stilettos, and her strawberry blonde hair is mostly a smooth curtain but with a slight wave toward her face, like a movie star from years gone by. I feel like I've made a mistake in my usually error-proof cute top and jeans.
Do I look that bad?
Andy laughs.
No, no, you look perfect. I just feel like I'm dressed all wrong.
Not that I have a couture dominatrix ensemble in my closet for occasions like this.
I'm probably overdressed, since I don't always get invited to these things.
The way her voice trails off makes me want to throw my arms around her. So she's subject to insecurity, too. She steps outside and closes the door behind her. I'm surprised she doesn't call back inside to Nolan or need to give Fisher one last kiss. Maybe the nanny is there and they've already said their goodbyes. Or maybe Nolan is actually out somewhere with Fisher. We've only just met, and I have no idea about the rhythms, routines, and inner workings of her home. Given my reaction to Nolan, it may be better that way. My current plan is to keep Andy at arm's length. I'm good at that. I have people to lunch with when I'm at work. There are a few couples who Doug and I socialize with, and that's pretty much it. My world is small and manageable. Andy's car is a midnight blue Lexus sedan, almost like an upscale police cruiser. I'm instantly at ease once inside because it's a total mess. A not entirely clean burp cloth on the floor, crumbs everywhere, an inch of dust on the dash. The fact that she offered to drive and then didn't think to tidy up suggests a level of intimacy between us. Either that, or she doesn't care in the slightest about my opinion of her. I was surprised when Andy offered to drive, since Main Street is a pretty short walk away. But after seeing her stilettos, it makes more sense. Then I realize we're headed in the other direction.
Where are we going? I ask.
A place called Hound, in Oakland.
We're not going to one of the bars on Main Street?
Andy gives me an odd look and an even odder response.
You don't shit where you eat.
It's 10 minutes of driving with a soundtrack of superficial chatter, and then we cross a steel gate bridge so that we're in one of the industrial areas of Oakland. Metal cranes sit immobile in the middle distance beside the bay. There are warehouses, some commercially inhabited but many more derelict and emblazoned with graffiti. The streets have a bombed-out look, but stylish people are loping along them, much younger people than Andy and me. Non-parents. At least parking is easy. There's only one place anyone's going, it seems like, and it's unmarked. I follow Andy, who is doing her usual confident trot, and we enter a tiny building dwarfed by the warehouses on either side. I've never seen a bar this dark, though there are paper lanterns hanging from the ceiling every few feet, casting the prototypical dive bar red light. I've also never seen a bar this long and narrow. The bartenders are situated along one wall, and there's a corridor to move back and forth, plus the tables, and it's all about 8 feet wide, total. People are dancing on tabletops, because where else could you do it? It's not exactly dancing, more like slithering, which makes sense because I've never heard music this slow. It's a syrupy trance, like you could fall in and never find your way out. A fly eventually hardened in amber. When we finally reach the back wall, after maneuvering around assorted hipsters with carefully careless outfits, I see a row of retro pinball machines. It's the most illumination in the place. Andy is texting. She reports,
"Their ETA is about 5 minutes. Should we get our drinks now or wait?"
"Let's wait," I say. I haven't yet decided if I'm drinking. Sadie is well stocked in her milk supply. A pump and dump wouldn't hurt her, but I should probably keep my wits about me.
"We can make ourselves useful," Andy says, "and find a few tables we can push together."
We squint our way through the din. Some tables are round, some oblong, and some square. It takes a while to find two squares, but we do it. Andy carries one over, stilettos be damned. Everyone gives her as wide a berth as they can, given the layout. It's actually a reasonably nice crowd, the way people are when they're all laboring under the same poor conditions. There's camaraderie in close quarters. Who picked this place? I ask. Once Andy and I are in our uncomfortable, mismatched wooden chairs. She shrugs. Tenny, I guess? She's the de facto leader, though Gina's got some pretty strong opinions, too. Have you heard her transurban riff? I'm considering whether to say something snarky when I look up and see Tennyson, Raquel, Gina, and Yolanda headed straight for us. Tennyson is wearing black leather, too, her hair in some intricate chignon, and she and Andy laugh in acknowledgement. Yolanda is also in black, showcasing her cleavage in a partially unzipped lycra top that has a particular sort of 80s workout vibe. Her blonde hair, long and loose, with that slight threat of frizz. The three of them are like Charlie's Angels, with their vampy outfits and their different hair colors. Meanwhile, Gina, Raquel, and I are matte to their shine, the backdrop that makes them sparkle like diamonds. Like me, Gina and Raquel are in jeans and cute tops. Gina, with her mushroom hair, you can't do a thing with that. Its only redeeming quality must be how wash and wear it is. And Raquel, in her ersatz granny glasses and limp brown hair. It's moms versus vixens tonight. There are hugs all around, and then we settle into chairs. I'm between Andy and Tennyson. What's with the music? Tennyson asks. It sounds like ice caps melting. Then, in case we didn't get it, glacial pace. You picked this place, Gina says. Don't complain. I wasn't complaining. I was noting. I like that you can actually hear people talk in this bar. She turns her phone outward and makes an exaggerated frown. June'll be late. It's gotta be another hope emergency, right? Tennyson looks around at all of us like someone might have insider information. Probably, Raquel says with a sympathetic expression. Poor June. This from Yolanda. You know June. She doesn't like to bring everyone else down by talking too much about it. But man, that's gotta be rough. Tennyson tosses her hair back. Her tone is compassionate, yet there may be a little underlying smugness. After all, she has a house full of teenagers herself. Running with the wrong crowd, you know? It can be scary. We all shake our heads, a prayer, a for the grace of God. Then Gina drums on the table. We're getting dangerously close to breaking the rule. We're not talking about our own kids, Raquel protests. But it's a slippery slope, Gina says. If we can't keep to one rule, what are we, animals? Hopefully. Tennyson gives a mischievous grin. I realize I haven't said anything. Neither has Andy. I'd assumed her self-possession extended to all scenarios. It's comforting to think it doesn't. That she's merely human. Except that when I look at her, I can't see any hint of her earlier nerves. She's just texting on her phone. If it were me, that would be the one rule. No phones. That's going to be my rule someday with Sadie. When we're together as a family, we turn everything else off. But that's just the kind of thing I'm not supposed to talk about tonight. So what do I say? First round's on me, Gina says. She smiles at me. In honor of our newest member. What are you drinking, Kat? She sounds perfectly friendly, yet it registers somehow as a challenge. I want to have the strength of character to say no. You're not supposed to be subject to peer pressure in your 30s. Well, what do they have? I ask. They don't have an actual menu, Tennyson says, but they do all kinds of stuff with crazy names, like the Silk Purse and the Velvet Revolver, Dead Man Walking. The Catapult is really good if you like tequila. It's a dive bar, so those drinks are going to be strong. And I haven't had alcohol in more than a year. And it seems prissy to order a Merlot. Do they make a sow's ear, too? Andy asks. Maybe it would have bacon bourbon. Have you guys ever had that? Everyone shakes their head. I'll have you all over soon.
She's wooing them, I realize, and her methods sound so much like Doug's. I think of Yolanda and Wyatt drinking Talisker in Crayola the other day, and how Yolanda seemed so sincere about wanting to get to know me better. But she's quiet tonight, almost surly. She's barely looked at me. Andy's complimenting Tennyson, another of Doug's techniques. Andy admitted the other night that she's not really part of the clique. So am I actually her way in? Is that why she reached out to me? I feel like she's already abandoning me for someone cooler. Not that it matters. I shouldn't be Andy's friend anyway. So what'll it be? Gina asks me, with a hint of impatience. Just a Coke, I say quietly, feeling like I'm letting them all down. But I can't afford to let go of my inhibitions. Everyone debates and then places their drink order with Gina, who makes her way over to the bar. We're allowed to talk about husbands, Tennyson announces. Like, can I just say, Doug is awesome? The other women nod enthusiastically. I should be grateful that Doug's a hit. Instead, I feel like the weaker part of the duo. Thanks, I say. He likes all of you, too. What's not to like? It comes out flirtatious, of course, but then it's Tennyson. I notice Yolanda stiffening, similar to when Wyatt mentioned Tennyson's name. It brings me back to the end of the block party, all those non-couples seeming to couple just for a moment. Then it was over so quickly, I thought maybe I'd imagined it.
The way Doug dotes on you and Sadie is so beautiful, Raquel says, and he's such a good listener and a good talker. Really, where did you find him?
Online, I say. It was efficient, but it makes for a crap story. They all smile.
Wyatt and I met in a bar, Yolanda says. That's not much better.
And you all know where I met Vic, Tennyson grins, just around the neighborhood.
It feels like an in-joke. For my benefit, she adds, we used to live around the corner from each other. I was on Overlook and he was on Tremont. Do you know that intersection? I indicate no. So his marriage was tanking and mine was too, and we found each other.
She means they had an affair.
Yolanda's voice is cold. She then turns toward Raquel in a very deliberate manner, engaging her in a low voice. I feel a little frozen out, but I'm thinking I shouldn't take it personally. It's really directed at Tennyson, and Tennyson must think so too, because she has the sort of bewildered and hurt expression that I'd associate with a much younger woman, a teenager, really, whose friends have just pulled a disappearing act.
It obviously worked out, Andy says. I mean, you're the happiest family in the AV.
Such a suck-up move, but she looks like she means it.
We're pretty happy, Tennyson allows, but I think Kat, Doug, and Sadie could give us a run for our money. I couldn't get over how cute you all were at the block party.
Thanks. I worry sometimes how I come off, since I'm not really a big group person. I sound pathetic, even to my own ears.
Don't judge me, please.
I'm great once you get to know me. I come with a 90-day warranty.
I'm more one-on-one, too, Tennyson says. Andy looks dubious. No, really, I am. You think I'm all fun and games? I've got layers, people. Seriously, I'm a Bermuda onion. We all laugh.
Gina returns with some drinks, and Raquel leaps up to grab the rest. When we each have a glass in front of us, Gina lifts hers.
To girls' night out, with all that it implies.
Everyone drinks. I learn that while we're not supposed to talk about kids directly, we can laugh at the ridiculous competition for the best preschools and the series of tests that two-year-olds are subjected to while their anxious mothers wait outside, like the kids' whole lives hang in the balance.
It's American Ninja Warrior. Toddler edition, Tennyson says.
I'll email you my research, Gina says to me in a low voice as a sidebar. Get Sadie on the list now.
I have the sense that Gina is wound a lot more tightly than the others, but that no one minds that, including her. I'm touched by her offer.
We all talk about the reality TV shows we're watching when we should be reading books with heft. We admit we don't want to join a book club unless it's for the wine. We trade harmless and amusing anecdotes about our husbands. The women compete for who's the worst driver, Tennyson wins, and who has the messiest car, Andy. We make faux confessions about biting our nails, Brazilian waxes gone wrong, and late-night binge eating. I realize I'm actually having fun. June arrives at our table, drink in hand, full of apologies that are immediately dismissed, but in the best way. She doesn't need to be forgiven. We're all friends here, and we make allowances for one another. Everyone starts reminiscing about stupid things they did in college, stupid boys they did in college. I'm laughing, though I still know to keep mum about my own exploits.
I didn't go to college, Raquel says, so I had to fuck things up in other ways.
She drains her glass. It's her second silk purse. She's slurring, just a little bit. While cursing still seems wrong from someone who appears as innocent as she does, I remind myself about East Oakland, crack, the BART train. She's lived, maybe as much as I have. My problem is, Tennyson says, and everyone perks up just a little, since Tennyson seems least likely to have problems. Vic and I have plenty of sex, but he still wants more. We all look a little disappointed. Her confession is sort of like when you're asked at a job interview about any weaknesses and you say you're too detail-oriented. It's really a strength. I mean, we could have guessed Tennyson and Vic were hot for each other all the time. There's no need to flaunt it in front of us mortals. When he wants sex and I don't, Tennyson continues, he gets all desperate and pushy. Sometimes he sulks. It's like, I've got enough kids. Raquel laughs loudly. Yes, you, of all people, have enough kids. Do you have an issue with the size of my family? Tennyson demands. We all fall silent. You don't just expect anyone to turn on Raquel. You make all these comments, Tennyson says. What is it, Raquel? You think we should have a one-child policy like China?
I don't think China has that policy anymore, June says in a charmingly inept attempt at deflection.
You want the truth, Raquel says. She doesn't wait for an answer. I think it's kind of messed up that your last child was a mistake.
Oh my God. Did she actually say that? I don't know if I've ever heard anything as ugly as calling someone else's child a mistake. No one moves. Andy freezes with her drink halfway to her mouth. Then Tennyson laughs.
I think it's messed up, too.
We all join in, relieved. Fight averted. I've never witnessed or been a part of friendships that can handle that degree of honesty. These women aren't just drinking buddies. There's a genuine depth to their connection. Part of me wants what they have. Another part is frightened by it.
Sex is one of our favorite topics on Girls' Night, June says. Whatever you do or don't do, there's no judgment.
For example, Gina tells me, I'm asexual. I just have no desire. Never have. But it's still fun to listen to my friends talk about it.
She must see the expression on my face because she adds,
Oliver's fine. We've worked out an arrangement.
If I were drinking like the rest of them, I might ask exactly what sort of arrangement she's talking about. But instead, I just nod, as if I meet people who proudly declare themselves asexual every day. It is pretty cool that someone as overtly sexual as Tennyson has no problem with it, that none of them does.
I want sex, I say. They all look at me, and I'm surprised to find that I spoke it out loud. I must have been lulled by the promise of all that acceptance. I don't desire sex, but I desire reassurance that it's normal not to. They're all looking at me expectantly, so I have to keep going. I don't want to just become Doug's roommate or just the mother of his child. My tone is full of sadness, and maybe that's why no one speaks for a long moment. Shame rushes in to fill the void.
I can't believe I just told a table full of women, of neighbors, that I have no desire for my husband.
If I wasn't attracted to Bart anymore, Raquel says, I'd feel the same way.
It's not that I'm not attracted to Doug, I say. It's that I'm not attracted to sex. I'm so tired all the time, and it just seems like a lot of work.
I never should have said anything. I'm not just your average new mom with no sex drive. It's a lot more complicated. And it all started much further back than having Sadie. In childhood, actually. But if Doug doesn't even know that, there's no way I'd ever tell a group of women I've just met. Only I already told them far more than I should have.
Sex is a lot of work, Gina says, for not a lot of payoff.
Your baby's only a few months old, Tennyson says. Give yourself a break.
Maybe you have postpartum, Yolanda says. That can definitely do a number on your sex drive.
Every relationship ebbs and flows, Raquel chimes in. I appreciate the chorus of support, but what I really want is to change the subject. Away from reality, back to reality TV. I want them to forget I ever said anything, not become an object of their pity.
Nolan and I have been married 9 years, Andy says, so I find that lately, I'm horny a lot more.
All the women laugh except me. June explains. In California, 10 years is the magic number. That's when alimony kicks in.
Wyatt and I haven't been doing it much lately, Yolanda says, her voice so low I have to lean in. Everyone else does the same. I can't blame him for not finding me very attractive anymore. I don't find myself very attractive these days.
Everyone tells her how gorgeous she is, and Yolanda seems bolstered. She's clearly a person who can take a compliment. So, they're not perfect. But Andy was right. They're all great. I've never been a joiner, but part of me does really want to be a regular. From here on out, I just need to keep my sex life to myself.
Chapter 9. Come outside, Cat. I've got a surprise for you. Hurry up, okay? Please? Pretty please? It's not even 5:30, which is earlier than Doug's been getting home, and the texts come one after the other, barely a pause between them. I step onto the front steps, leaving the door open behind me so that I can hear Sadie if she wakes up. A pickup truck is double-parked, and Doug and a grizzled man are lifting two bikes onto the sidewalk, one red and one blue. Crayola colors. They look brand new.
That's not all, Doug says.
He's practically vibrating with excitement. It's so strong, it's seismic. You can measure it with a Geiger counter. He steps back into the bed of the truck with a ta-da motion. The object of his affection has two large bicycle tires on the sides and is encased in bright yellow fabric with mesh inserts. There's a silver hitch.
It's a bike trailer, so Sadie can attach to one of our bikes and we can all go riding together.
I have to choose my words carefully. You want to go riding with a newborn?
She's not that newly born anymore, Cat.
He turns to the other man.
This is Milo. He just happened to be in the bike store when I was there, and he offered to help. Otherwise, I would have had to buy a bike rack to get these babies home. I mean, we'll need one anyway, but still. It was pretty awesome of him. Milo, meet Cat.
Hi, Milo, I say. Nice to meet you.
Congratulations on the move. You're gonna love it. You won't believe how many kick-ass trails you can get to from here in like 5 minutes.
It's funny to hear kick-ass from a 50-year-old man, but then he's not a mere man. He's part wildebeest. I've never seen a beard that bushy in person before. Thanks, I tell him, for bringing the bikes home.
My pleasure. Enjoy 'em.
I wait until he's back in the truck and has pulled away before I turn to Doug, who is eagerly awaiting my reaction.
What were you thinking? I hiss.
The hurt on his face is instant.
and it pains me to see it, to cause it, but I can't humor him. We're probably skating into overdraft territory. Can you return all this? I ask. He shakes his head